The Partially Examined Life depends on your support. To find out how to do that in ways that are cheap or even free, go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/support.
If you like audiobooks, then you need to check out today's sponsor, Audible.com. They have over 250,000 titles from leading audiobook publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, magazine and newspaper publishers, and business information providers. You can catch up on all the hot new books you've been meaning to read while on your daily commute with Audible.com. And of course, there are many awesome philosophy titles, both explaining classic figures and informing you about the ideas hotly debated today. And hey, if you search for my name, Mark Linsenmeyer, you can find several audiobooks that I've narrated. Just for listeners, Audible.com is offering a free 30-day trial membership. Go to audible.com/PEL today to start your free trial. You're listening to The Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who were at one point set on doing philosophy for a living but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 141 is something like, how does recognition of our freedom affect what we should do ethically and politically? And we're continuing our discussion of Simone de Beauvoir's The Ethics of Ambiguity from 1947, this time covering part 3, The Positive Aspect of Ambiguity. You can join the discussion, get the text, and lots more information at partiallyexaminedlife.com. This is Mark Linsenmeyer, rationalistically optimistic, in Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Seth Paskin, having abandoned his past to the night of facticity in Austin, Texas.
This is Wes Allwun, making the means justify the ends in Boston, Massachusetts.
This is Dylan Casey, choosing between contingent absurdity and rationalistic necessity in Middleton, Wisconsin.
Last time, and folks should listen to the previous episode before this, because we're really just going to continue where we left off with that. But we laid out Simone de Beauvoir's existentialist take on the ambiguity of existence. You know, are we're things in the world, yet we are free. And freedom was supposed to have the implication that not only do we will our own freedom, but if we're doing it self-consistently, we're willing other people's freedom as well. And so that's sort of the starting point for all of this. We've talked a lot about in other episodes the existentialist sort of creative idea of morality that maybe Nietzsche came up with. That we create our own values, but there's nothing external. There's nothing written in the sky that we can just point at and say, oh, that's what I'm supposed to do. No, we have more responsibility than that.
But what
does that mean politically? How do we then, because when we talked about Nietzsche and other folks like that, it seemed hard for us, you know, Nietzsche himself seemed to just shy away from the political. So Simone de Beauvoir does not.
Just to touch on the previous episode, the question of the first part was really how an existentialist ethics can actually be an ethics if there's no external standard of right and wrong. And her reply is that actually such external standards make ethics impossible. If we have some absolute external standard, we can lose our subjectivity in that. We can cease to be subjects by having this idea that we can fill ourselves by reaching those ends. Being ethical requires maintaining subjectivity, maintaining this lack, maintaining this desire, which implies that our ends are freely created by ourselves rather than coming from without. And to be free, we have to sustain that freedom, which means our ends are not ultimates, but they're sort of the point of departure for new possibilities. And to sustain it beyond even our own lifetimes, we have to will the freedom of others. It's sort of almost like bequeathing or like having offspring, living on in our children. When we will the freedom of others, our freedom sort of lives on in them. And that's why that's ethically necessary. So then the question is what that looks like, what all that abstract stuff actually looks like in the world.
So that's the beginning, that's chapter 3 then?
No, I was just segueing from the previous episode 2.
Well, the beginning of chapter 3 does have a little summary at the beginning that looks nice, but I wanted to hear from Seth first. What did you think of this?
I was thinking about it after reading this, putting together our reading list for what we've done on the podcast. After 140 episodes, and I was like, wow, that's a hell of a syllabus. But I was struck by this particular work. I felt she's challenging a little bit with the language, but an extremely strong reasoner, articulates the argument of the text very well. And even though I'm ultimately sympathetic to the existentialist ethical agenda, which means maybe my judgment needs to be questioned in this case, everything she's talking about to me seems almost right on, like dead on. So as far as I'm concerned, this is the handbook that I'm going to live the rest of my life by.
Yeah, it is sort of like a really sophisticated self-help book. You don't want to be the serious man. You don't want to be the nihilist or the adventurer.
I would maybe agree with that for the first half. For this, the second half, I found a little more problematic that we'll talk about today. Just what is she actually recommending in terms of revolution? I mean, she talks a lot about the problematics of violence and how trying to accomplish anything politically will involve violence, will involve sacrifice, which often means that you are violating this Kantian, you know, treat everyone as an end, as an absolute. And there's something, I absolutely agree with her, that you can never justify, even if you justify an action, a political action that results in the deaths of people enough to do it, you can't then sit back and feel good about that and feel like, oh, I followed the utility calculus and I let one person die as opposed to 10. And so that's fine. I'm a hero, in fact. No, that's always tragic. So that her verdict lines up with the sentiment that I've often expressed about the ultimate tragedy of human morality. But I didn't leave this really knowing, wait, should I be a communist? I'm not really.
Well, I think that was the whole point of her ending, though, is that you can't be prescriptive in that way.
But she does reject sort of collectivism. So
yes.
Yeah, she rejects collectivism, and this whole thing grew out of living through the Nazi occupation of France. So merely saying, oh, I'm going to take the long view and just be into my art or into my philosophy or whatever and ignore what's politically going on because all these things shall pass, that is cowardly in some way. This whole thing is stacked that there should be action in the face of that, and that there's no formula for telling you exactly what action to take.
Yeah, it's more than cowardly, right? I mean, she would say that it falls into the same trap as the oppressors themselves, at least philosophically, if not ethically, that not taking action is not being ethical, period.
We should say there are really, there's kind of two senses of action here. One she calls positive and one negative. And
yeah,
the bulk of it is this negative sense of rebelling or having a revolution against people who are oppressing you. That's an assertion of freedom. But there is this mm-hmm. positive, constructive assertion of freedom, which is the one she starts out with, which is, you can think of it as largely the products of the arts and sciences, the things that we do that are work, basically, our creativity.
And she thinks that the positive aspect is the greater one, but that there's commonly situations in which the only manifestation of your freedom is in rebelling. And in fact, it becomes quite a problematic thing when in that rebelling, you attain the end of that rebelling, which is just sort of that lack. You end up free in the sense of lacking that constraint. And then making the transition into positive freedom can be really challenging, socially, personally, individually, politically.
So this part three here is divided into five sections. Mm-hmm. The first one is called the aesthetic attitude, which kind of continues the negative takes on freedom that we talked about in the previous sections. But the very beginning of it has a nice, sort of a slightly different take on why asserting my own freedom means asserting the freedom of others. It's not just so after I die, people can continue. She says, every man has to do with other men. The world in which he engages himself is a human world in which each object is penetrated with human meanings. It is a speaking world from which solicitations and appeals rise up. This means that through this world, each individual can give his freedom a concrete content. So that's kind of the key here. It's freedom in the abstract. If you're on an island by yourself, asserting your freedom, I mean, yeah, you could still choose to kill yourself or choose to try to make the best of things or whatever. You still have choices. But that would not give your freedom concrete content. And so just like all those discussions about the self, where merely asserting your independence doesn't actually form a positive self, it's the Hegelian move, you know, that Hegel described of bouncing yourself off someone else, getting their take on you, and then you reacting to that. And so you become an object in the world that way, and then have at least something to work with. You don't have to then just be what they say you are, but that's at least a stage in the formation of a self. And so it's, I think this is part of one and the same phenomena here.
I think listeners might be wondering why she's starting with the aesthetic attitude. And I think if you revisit our Schopenhauer and Kant on the aesthetic judgment episode, you'll get a sense of that, because the idea is that there's a certain freedom to taking the aesthetic attitude. You know, so for Schopenhauer, it was freedom from desire. When I paint an apple and contemplate it that way, I free myself from simply material desire to eat the apple. And she discusses ways in which we might even look at human action through this sort of detached aesthetic contemplation. And I think she might be thinking to some extent of Nietzsche, right, supplanting morality with this sort of aesthetic take on life. But she rejects that because it really provides no basis for action.
This is kind of the way that Sartre's very radical form of freedom was originally explained to me, was that whatever's going on to you, you have the power to interpret it however you want within some reason, but at least you could identify with what's happening. And so we saw this really cashed out in the Stoics, which I think is part of who Sartre must have been drawing on in coming up with this. And Simone de Beauvoir addresses the Stoics several times in here, that if something is outside of your control, you can just decide that it doesn't matter. And so, yeah, you could kind of do that with all the things that are happening around you. You could just say, I'm not going to take the default animal attitude of going towards something that is lovely and away from something that is horrible. Because if you live like that, then, well, a lot of horrible stuff happens. So you're going to be suffering a lot. You're going to be running away a lot. So maybe you should take a more detached attitude to just kind of be able to take everything in. And that seems like it's a more sophisticated take on life. But for the reasons you just said, that's not going to be enough.
And it essentially treats people as objects. It treats them as mere disclosures, which is another way of saying experiences, as opposed to these subjectivities in themselves, which is why this segues into the idea of needing to will the freedom of others.
Yes. She refers, as Marx said, directly to the context of World War II on page 81, after she's talked a little bit about the aesthetic attitude, and she refers to, it's a little bit long, but I'll read it. One can imagine an intellectual Florentine being skeptical about the great uncertain movements which are stirring up his country and which will die out as did the seethings of the centuries which have gone by. As he sees it, the important thing is merely to understand the temporary events and through them to cultivate that beauty which perishes not. Many Frenchmen also sought relief in this thought in 1940 and the years which followed. Let's try to take the point of view of history, they said upon learning that the Germans had entered Paris. And during the whole occupation, certain intellectuals sought to keep aloof from the fray and to consider impartially contingent facts which did not concern them. But we note at once that such an attitude appears in moments of discouragement and confusion. In fact, it is a position of withdrawal, a way of fleeing the truth of the present. So we were just saying that part of this is looking on other people and events as mere objects. And I think that's part of what's her analysis with the looking on history and taking the position of, let's take look at it as the way history goes and be aloof from it, as if things are just merely happening to you and that there is no action required. I guess is directly the stoical attitude that Mark was referring to.
Yeah, the problem with that aesthetic attitude is that you withdraw or you try to detach yourself from things as if things are what could possibly provide meaning or could possibly be oppressive. So it's a double failure to withdraw in that manner. The first is because you're withdrawing from other people whose freedom, in addition to your own, you have to will. But it's also a failure because you are assigning to things and objects powers that they do not have.
So yeah, I think our main problem is if we take the aesthetic attitude towards the present. So in the past, she says something like, in the past, there are no choices to be made, right?
Exactly. Yep.
But the present is this, quote unquote, the moment of choice and action. So if we take, you know, an aesthetic attitude towards the present, then we're withdrawing. It seems like there's that freedom in, right, absenting ourselves from desire and retreating into aesthetic contemplation. But really, freedom in the present involves making choices. So if we try and flee that contemplatively, we are fleeing freedom.
So when we say we're fleeing freedom, why is that not a free act?
Well, it is and it isn't. She went over this in the last.
Yeah.
She asked that question. I think she might re-ask it in this chapter as well, which is that, you know, there's that paradox of, well, if we're all free, how can we will ourselves to be
exactly free?
And the idea is that we are all free in this sort of fundamental sense, but we can either will our own freedom or we can fail to do that. We can flee and not do that, which is not the same thing as saying that we're willing ourselves not to be free. That's not something she thinks we can do, but we can sort of just not do it.
So it's sort of an incontinence with respect to our freedom.
Right. I think she even uses the word laziness at points.
Yeah.
Things like the words like that. Yeah.
You're not free to be unfree?
Well, yes, we are condemned to be free. That's Sartre.
But being lazy is different.
But you're not condemned to will your own freedom. So it's really two tiers. You know, in some sense, everyone is free, but that doesn't mean everyone is autonomous. That doesn't mean that everyone is acting morally in the sense of willing their own freedom and doing all that stuff.
That itself is one of the statements of our, the ambiguity of our nature.
Exactly.
We're free, but yet we need extra, actually the willing act
you,
to.
You need to activate
to
your
really
freedom.
Be free.
Yeah. I thought Dylan was asking something else. Like if I choose not to will myself to be free, how is that not freedom?
Right. It is freedom. It's just not self-consistent, paradox-free freedom.
You could say it's freedom, but not autonomy. It's not action. It's a failure to act.
Yeah. It's a little bit different than the kind of self-subjugation, you know, the serious man or the cause-oriented person who ties himself unambiguously to a cause, which it's still a failure of activating their freedom, but it's a different kind of failure. They're being active in some way, but they are not really instantiating their freedom for all the reasons we talked about in the last episode about the failures of the serious man.
So towards the end of the section, I think she gives a good summary of this. So page 83 in mine, in the last paragraph. So she had been talking about the way in which a writer might sort of write aesthetically about things that are horrible, including the past. And then she starts this paragraph with, "But here too, we must not confuse the present with the past. With regard to the past, no further action is possible. All that we can do is to reveal it, to reveal these horrors, to integrate it into the human heritage, to raise it to the dignity of an aesthetic experience, which bears within itself its finality." So when we're writing about things like the Holocaust or terrible things like that, yes, there's no problem raising that to the dignity of an aesthetic experience. It's already happened. There's no choices to be made.
The dignity of the aesthetic existence.
Sorry.
Interestingly.
Existence, sorry.
I think that's an interesting distinction.
No, I mean, yeah, I wasn't thinking experience. I was just saying it. So, I mean, it's an aesthetic existence in the sense, right? It's you've represented it, and now it has an existence as this sort of representation as well. In and of itself, this terrible thing that happened in the past, it's just this terrible thing that happened in the past. But as represented, it's now this aesthetic object, also this aesthetic object. Today must also exist before being confirmed in its existence. It exists only as an engagement and a commitment. If we first considered the world as an object to be manifested, if we thought that it was saved by this destination in such a way that everything about it already seemed justified and that there was no more of it to reject, then there would also be nothing to say about it, for no form would take shape in it. It is revealed only through rejection, desire, hate, and love.
The next sentence is the one that I had picked out. In order for the artist to have a world to express, he must first be situated in this world, oppressed or oppressing.
Yeah, so before the artist can take this detached aesthetic standpoint, you know, so before there's the representation of the apple detached from the desire for it, we have to have a world in which we are have a desired engagement with apples. One thing presupposes the other. So the artist doesn't even get off the ground. The one world, the world of the aesthetic, presupposes the world of action. But I think the main point of the previous paragraph is that to treat the world as simply like an object, like an aesthetic object, and rob it of engagement and commitment would, in a way, to make it not to exist. It couldn't be the thing that we call the world if it didn't involve this relationship of desire, hate, or love. We have to have these sort of practical attitudes toward the world for it to be what we call the world. So we can't simply say, you know, oh, I'm just going to take this detached aesthetic attitude toward things, because there are no things without that, towards which to take that. We have to start from the standpoint of commitment and desire before we move to the next step.
One interesting thing about that is going back to the question of metaphysics earlier on, that was just sort of underlying some of what she's been talking about. That action, that concreteness, that activity is the way of instantiating the world. In some ways, the problem of the aesthetic attitude is that, just as you said now, Wes, is that there aren't things there, and you have to have things in order to act upon them. You have to have things in order to act. That drives your any kind of practical action. You have to instantiate it as a thing or something, and you move towards it. And if you don't do that, then you're not going to move anywhere. To me, it made sense of her focusing on action, which I think underlies the reason why she says existential ethics is in some ways the only ethics available. It's the only way in which you can talk about actually acting.
It sounds like we might have overstated the epistemological point here, because if you want to say that you have to be truly engaged in the world in order for there to be things at all, then that would mean that the people who are moral failures on her part, who do not engage themselves in the world, who are subman, don't actually have a world. Not just that they are not driven to autonomous action, but that there are no objects for them to perceive. And that's clearly not what she's saying.
Yeah, no, not that you have to be morally engaged, but just that you have to have these practical attitudes. You could be a complete moral failure and still have desire, hate, and love, and all the other attitudes. And even if you're apathetic, I think that one of the points she made with the subman in the previous chapter is that's still a choice of sorts, and it still represents a kind of practical attitude. It's not simply the disappearance of all attitudes whatsoever.
All right, so section two, freedom and liberation. This is the one that I think was really the crux, as far as I was concerned, before we got into the difficult stuff about how many people to sacrifice in a war and things like that.
Well, I know. I just think the problem, you know, maybe we should just start with the problem that she's sort of addressing, which is that, hey, it's all well and good to say we want to will freedom, but what is the content of that, right? And that, in a way, is kind of the whole point of this chapter. The larger point here is that, well, when we disclose being, you know, willing freedom and disclosing being are the same thing, ultimately. The way to think about disclosing being is just as this existentialist version of Kant's construction of appearances. It's about the having of experiences, but also the experience of one's own action in the world. So when you think about being an artist or being a scientist and completing projects and bringing about these concrete results, you know, these inventions or books or paintings and things like that, that's a form of disclosure that gives concrete expression to our freedom.
That seems right. She does want to qualify both, maybe in particular in the case of science, but also in terms of art, that it matters how you do both those things. In the third paragraph in section two, on my page 85, she says, science condemns itself to failure when, yielding to the infatuation of the serious, it aspires to attain being, to contain it, and to possess it. But it finds its truth if it considers itself as a free engagement of thought in the given, aiming at each discovery, not at fusion with the thing, but at the possibility of new discoveries. What the mind then projects is the concrete accomplishment of its freedom. You know, in a funny way, she's, you know, taking a position on a philosophy of science question of, are there real laws and what is science trying to do, and setting herself right down on the side of science as a evolving, that the ends of science are evolving creative activities, that you, there's nothing strange or quizzical about the fact that you have evolving theories that are in their moments and in their times concrete. And they have to be that way. You have to be able to engage them, but they're always at the same time transitory. And that's not problematic.
Yeah. But, and also, if they weren't, we would cease to be free, right? If we had all the final, if we knew everything about the world, and if we had done everything that's artistically possible, if there were all these external absolute ends in the world and we had sort of consumed them all, then there'd be nothing left for us. There would be nothing to aspire to, no goals, no ends, nothing, yes, nothing to do. As such, we would no longer be subjects. We would just be things, among other things.
Yep.
Before we go further, let's talk a minute about our sponsors. First, I want to tell you again about the Great Courses Plus, which is a great online video learning service giving you unlimited access to over 7,000 fascinating video lectures taught by award-winning professors. Now, these lectures go over many subjects. In fact, just this week, my daughter and I were watching one on how to play chess better. There are plenty of offerings specifically aimed at lovers of this podcast. That is, courses in philosophy, in religion, in science, psychology, history, literature, and more. I wanted to tell you this time about The Big Questions of Philosophy, a 36-lecture course by Professor David K. Johnson that covers the gambit: truth, knowledge, personal identity, the good, the power of government, justice, the meaning of life. I took a look at lectures 17 and 18 on freedom. Do we have free will? How is that compatible with the findings of neuroscience? These are fast-paced, easy to understand, great supplements for a more interactive presentation like we have here at the Barsley Examine Life. I think you'll love the Great Courses Plus like I do. If you sign up today as one of my podcast listeners, you'll immediately receive 1 month free to start watching as many lectures as you want, including the entirety of The Big Questions of Philosophy. You can watch these anywhere, anytime, on your TV, laptop, tablet, or smartphone. To start your free trial today, sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/PEL. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/PEL.
Today's show is also sponsored by libertarianism.org. I spoke to the good people at libertarianism.org and took the opportunity to peruse their site, looking at some of the content they've got there. It's a really nice layout, and they have some very quality resources on libertarianism, which we've discussed in previous episodes, for example, our episode on Nozick. The folks there wanted me to let you know about libertarianism.org guides. Libertarianism.org guides are self-paced online courses taught by top professors and experts. They are completely free and no sign-up of any kind is required. Now, the libertarianism.org guides introduce the basic ideas and principles of a free and flourishing society and serve as a path to further learning. The guides include an introduction to political philosophy featuring Jason Brennan and an introduction to libertarianism featuring David Boas, with many more to come. If you'd like to explore libertarian ideas for a free and flourishing society, libertarianism.org guides will help you get your footing. You can find the libertarianism.org guides on libertarianism.org.
Before we get back to it, I wanted to announce the after show covering all of the Simone de Beauvoir episodes, 140 and 141, will take place on Sunday, June 26th at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. This gives you a chance to get in on the conversation. I'm going to be on it. Comedian Danny Lobel. We're going to try to have a Simone de Beauvoir scholar and other listeners. To attend, you have to become a Partially Examined Life citizen. Go sign up at partiallyexaminedlife.com. However, anybody can just watch it as it happens on the Partially Examined Life Citizen YouTube channel. We will link to that from the blog. All right, so we were talking about how ethics, like science, should not be about aiming at some pre-existent objective standard, but about a creative addition to what we already know or think we know. So I find it interesting to contrast this to the idea, like in Descartes' argument for the existence of God, that unless there is an ultimate, unless there is a limit, then these gradations, these creative acts on an individual level wouldn't mean anything. We wouldn't understand that they were progress unless we had in mind that there is some ideal, that there is some form, some ultimate, that eventually, even if none of our actions could reach that, that is sort of the implicit goal of whatever we're trying to do. So that a scientist is trying to elaborate the truth, the whole truth.
Yeah, and for her, she's explicitly saying, well, there is an ultimate goal, but that ultimate goal has to be freedom. If we make the ultimate goal this externality, we screw everything up.
You still have to have that externality, but it has to be held ambiguously in the sense that you do have an understanding that, oh, I want to try to understand how the whole world works, right? But if you are too serious about that, then you won't actually maintain the progress of science. In fact, you might decide in 1870, oh, you know what? We figured everything out. Everything is just engineering from now on.
But also, this is the like another aspect where it's like a self-help book. To be free, you've got to be able to deal with failure. You've got to realize that failure is an inherent part of projects. If something is an ultimate end, then falling short of it is sort of ruinous. It actually makes it hard to act. It also becomes hard to act if the end is so absolute that it's sort of this final termination, that it's like death. Well, we don't want to die. We don't want to cease to act. So it's kind of scary if these ends are so absolute. If they are sort of provisional, if they're sort of stepping stones to new actions, new possibilities, which is what she wants to make them, they're in a sense more doable. And then the absolute sort of lies within us. It's this willing towards our own freedom. So each particular end could fail, you know, like a Van Gogh, we could cease to have the possibility of painting, but we wouldn't cease to have the possibility of asserting our own freedom.
So you might want to equate freedom with power. It seems like somebody that doesn't have any power doesn't have any freedom. But she wants to distinguish those because it would follow from that, oh, do I have the freedom to fly? Like, well, no, you can't fly. So therefore, does that mean that you're somehow restricted? You can't fly? But she says the resistance of things, page 81 in my version, a couple pages into the section, this is all by contrast to the resistance of people, which people can be actually oppressive. But she says, no, when things get in the way of something we're trying to do, the resistance of the thing sustains the action of man as air sustains the flight of a dove. And by projecting himself through it, man accepts its being an obstacle. He assumes the risk of a setback in which he does not see a denial of his freedom. And it even uses science as one of the examples of the scientists that a certain phenomenon may remain obscure to him. So it's sort of like that's what accomplishing something is. In fact, we do have the freedom to fly. Go build an airplane. That was something that we had to figure out. So it's a matter of what, when you say you accomplished an action, what are you actually saying that you did? Well, I overcame these obstacles. And so obstacles, even in the simplest sort of action, to describe what you did, you really, you know, how did you point at him? Well, I lifted my hand. I overcame whatever resistance gravity and my own biology might have exerted, and figuring out where the person is to point at him and whatever other obstacles. That's what an action is overcoming obstacles in some sense. The obstacles give content to what it is you're doing. That is what it means, that exerting your freedom for it to have external content means that you're engaging with the world, for it to not to be empty.
That's why activities like climbing mountains or sailing, doing something arduous, really is a instantiation of your freedom, in part because Mount Everest can't oppress you. It can limit you, right? Or a hurricane and the earthquake can constrain you and you overcome it, but they can't oppress you. Only other human beings can oppress you.
Yeah, because only human beings can deny you a future, can deny you your possibilities, which is, for her, is the meaning of oppression. To have hard things to do and to maybe not be able to do them as well as we want, or get halfway up the mountain, that's not a denial of possibility or of a future. That's just us progressing along the path into the future.
But this way of putting things and distinguishing, like, I agree that this is a proper description of what an action is and so forth, by, you know, when you take on a task, that there can be these obstacles. And even if you assume the risk when you're doing it, and it's almost like it's the action that matters. Even if you fail, the failures can be interesting. They can tell you something. You know, we know how that works in science. We know how that works in art, that you create something and you learn something from it. But I'm not sure why, and it almost seems to me that most actions involve people in this way as well. If my action is we want to have a hugely influential podcast, well, that it means we're influencing people to tune in, to recommend it to their friends, whatever. It's not merely overcoming a technical obstacle of distributing it on the internet or whatever. Even those technical obstacles seem to rely very heavily on people. And of course, the main point of this, the way it all led off, is it's we need other people's freedom in order for our actions to become positive and real. So even though she talks about how other people can oppress us and they can stop our freedom, I'm not sure why this point about obstacles doesn't also apply to actions involving people too. In other words, we can use people as means as long as they're not merely means.
Other people can be in that way part of the environment, part of our circumstance and contingency that we overcome, and are things in that respect.
Yeah, I think she would agree with that, though. Why do you think she would disagree with that?
I thought Mark was noticing that in her examples, they were all sort of non-human environmental factors, not the examples that he gave.
I guess it was when there was resistance involved, and she's saying, if it's just the mountain that's resisting you, that's not oppression. If it's a person that's resisting you, it's oppression. But if a person is resisting my podcast becoming famous because they don't like it, they're not oppressing me.
She's not saying all resistance you receive from people is oppression. She's just saying that no resistance you receive from things can be oppression. Those two points are different. So yeah, there's plenty of resistance from people in the world that doesn't count as oppression.
Yeah, I mean,
unless you're really, really sensitive, and then
participation in preventing another from positive entrance of freedom is oppression.
Yeah.
Yep.
You have to deny something for someone, not merely, you know, be a thing in their path.
Cutting people off from their future. It's on page 88. It is other men who open the future to me. So our futures rely on other people in a way that they don't rely on things. It is they who, setting up the world of tomorrow, define my future, but if instead of allowing me to participate in this constructive movement, they oblige me to consume my transcendence in vain, if they keep me below the level which they have conquered and on the basis of which new conquests will be achieved, then they are cutting me off from my future, they are changing me into a thing. So I thought that is sort of the definitive way of describing oppression.
But how is it really different than an oppressive heat, or I suffer an oppressive injury, something like that? I mean, yes, even in those circumstances, I retain some freedom. But even in a circumstance where somebody is chaining me down, as de Beauvoir would, of course, agree, this is one of Sartre's examples, I still retain freedom in that case. So It seems the only reason you'd want to call one oppression and the other not is because of the kind of activity you would take to redress it.
Yeah, but if you say it's an oppressive heat, you're anthropomorphizing something that's not actually oppression.
But it's limiting just the definition that Wes just gave. It's limiting my possibilities. It's limiting my action in a sort of systematic way.
But it's not the same. Again, I don't think resistance to action is the same thing as limitation of action. She's not. So, for instance, I mean, consider the difference between just not having access to a printing press or not being a writer or something like that versus a governmental apparatus which prevents you from free speech or something like that, which cracks down on it. The first thing can be just seen as sort of a technical problem to be solved. Maybe there are other ways of expressing myself. Maybe I can get access to a printing press, become a writer, do whatever it takes. But the second one involves me being violent towards other people. I don't have to be violent towards anything to resolve resistance from things. But if it's oppression from people, then gaining my freedom is intimately connected to depriving them of theirs, if they're the oppressors, or depriving them of their lives.
Well, so what about if you're in a situation where, you know, you've had a drought in your area, the oppressive heat that's not really oppressing you, so there's really no food, but yet other people down the road have food and they're not giving it to you. So it would involve, just as you say, doing violence against other people, just like the printing press being out of my hands to get that. So even though, you know, that's not normally the kind of thing we think those people just by having food are oppressing me. That's certainly not something that our libertarian friends would like. But that seems to follow from the description here that, yeah, somebody can, just by being in the situation that they are, having the thing that you need that you can't get any other way than by asking or fighting them for it, are oppressing you if they don't share or give you some means.
So I don't, I don't think that's true either. I mean, it has something to do with other freedoms, you know, as she likes to call people sometimes, other freedoms thwarting your freedom as opposed to the world simply resisting your freedom. So, you know, if a government is prohibiting me from free speech, in some sense, that is just resistance, right? If I thought of people as automatons, if I thought of them as just like other things in the world, as obstacles like that, you could think of it in that way. But they are also subjectivities. They are also free beings. And my autonomy relies on them. I can't be free unless I'm in a community of other free people who sort of enable my action.
Well, I think this might be a place where we can invoke Kant. Oppression, in some sense, requires that you're treating somebody else as a thing, which is one way of saying you're treating them as a means as opposed to an end. You know, the difference is in saying that, for example, there's a scarcity of resources, Mark, and you say, hey, there's 10 people in this community and there's only enough food for five. So the five people with the food are oppressing the five people without the food. You know, that's not what's happening. That is one of those situations that she talks about later, where she talks about the necessity sometimes of doing violence via resistance. You're not oppressing somebody if you're in a situation where your self-preservation dictates that somebody else may not be preserved because you're not consciously, actively treating them like a thing. It's the unfortunate fact of existence. And then the burden is on us to make sense of it.
Well, I thought that she conceded that you would be treating them as a thing, and that was unavoidable. That in the case Mark brought up, you're starving to death and there's a closed community that you're outside the walls for and they won't let you in. And
there's nothing in that example that says, and they don't let you in because they only have enough for themselves. Like, that's not at all the parallel that I was trying to bring, that they have plenty, let's say.
Yeah, I think the example works probably even better if you just say, they just don't want to share, right? They're not preventing you from going to get your stuff anywhere else. They're just preventing you from accessing the plenty that they have. And they aren't taking any other actions against you other than not opening the door. And so if, you know, you are on the outside and you go in and scale the walls or dig a tunnel and go in and maybe you have to, whatever you're doing, you are treating them as a thing. I think she concedes that.
But are they oppressing you by keeping you out? You all seem to agree that they're not. But I was thinking, if we're looking at this whole part of this book as the foundation for what's going to constitute legitimate social action and revolution and all this, then I would think that she would want to come down on the side of, yes, actually, they are oppressing you, even though they're not doing anything purposefully nasty. If they know that you need this and they know they have enough and could share and don't, then they are oppressing you.
They're denying your future.
Yeah.
Actually, I don't think they are, though. Because to deny someone's future, you have to do something unethical to them. You can't simply be in the way. You can't be simply an obstacle like other things in the world are obstacles.
Why is not providing a man dying of thirst, refusing to provide them water, standing there with the water, refusing to provide them water, why is that not unethical?
Yeah, if we come up with a...
That's the example. That's straight up the example.
And the parallel, of course, being for the bourgeois versus the...
The point is not your particular example. The point... I thought Mark was using another... I was referring back to another ethical dilemma where it's simply a matter of other people having things that we needed and they needed them too. So that falls in the category of an ethical dilemma, and I don't think that's really a useful illustration. Yeah, if people are actively and unethically harming us, then I think that falls within the category of oppression. But the main point to keep in mind, the difference between simply scarcity in the world, for instance, and oppression is that our futures are defined by other people, by the recognition of other people. That's why they can be oppressors. Our futures are not defined by whether or not we get what we want in terms of things. That's not what she means by having a future. To have a future means to be one of many, to exist in a community of people who have essentially goodwill towards me and are not thwarting my autonomy out of their unethical attitudes.
Here's another quote just on the next page. Only man can be an enemy for man. Only he can rob him of the meaning of his acts and his life, because it also belongs only to him alone to confirm it in its existence, to recognize it in actual fact as a freedom. So that sounds more like what you were saying, Wes, that it's not a matter of things, it's a matter of conferring meaning on your acts.
Right.
We should pick out the places where she rips on Stoicism here. It is here that the Stoic distinction between things which do not depend upon us and those which depend upon us proves to be insufficient, for we is legion and not an individual. Each one depends upon others, and what happens to me by means of others depends upon me as regards its meaning. One does not submit to a war or an occupation as he does to an earthquake. He must take sides for or against, and the foreign wills thereby become allied or hostile. It is this interdependence which explains why oppression is possible and why it is hateful.
Here's another example, and then I'll get off this. If my leg gets torn off by a bear in the woods, that's not oppression. That doesn't deny me a future in the sense or my freedom. But if a human being does it, it does. Because to be an autonomous individual, and this is sort of Kant's point, I have to operate in a world that consists of more than bad actors. In a world where everyone else is behaving unethically, I lose the ability to be autonomous myself. That's the sense in which I can lose my future and my freedom.
So if you've got a negative view of human nature, none of us have the ability to perform autonomous actions because everybody's unethical.
Well, to the extent that, you know, to the extent that not you're not being oppressed, you're not being oppressed, right? No one's interfering with our podcast. We are actors in the world, and yeah. So
this way of thinking explains to me a lot more about why we get so much more upset about a terrorist act that killed one person, or maybe killed no one, upset in a completely different way than a natural disaster that killed 1,000 people. Or,
yeah,
you know, 30,000 people a year die in car accidents, and we rise up against an act of human violence in our community in a way that we would never rise up against those car accidents, even if the human toll is fractionally smaller.
Yeah, that's because in one case, it's simply our physical well-being that's at stake. But in another, it's our spiritual well-being. If you think in terms of Hegelian recognition, my existence as a subject depends upon the recognition of other subjects. And that recognition involves their ethical comportment to me. So in a sense, I'm being threatened as an ethical being. I can be turned into a thing by that kind of behavior, whereas an earthquake can't do that to me.
That's the same thing as saying they're denying me my freedom, and the earthquake's not.
Someone who harms me and willfully does something terrible to me is depriving me of ethical recognition, and that's a different sort of danger than simply getting harmed physically. And that's why we react to harms which come from people differently than those that come from things.
Yeah.
There's another type of damage being done.
So I was trying to think of what the silly response to the car example. It's the technocratic industrial complex that is forcing me to live in a society with cars and forcing all the accidents on us. And of course, the response to that is, well, you know, you chose to drive, you're complicit. And I've been looking at this whole thing through the lens of how are we going to talk about oppression of the kind of stuff bell hooks was talking about, the patriarchy and crap like that. You're living in a society where this sort of does oppress all of those involved, yet you're complicit in it. You're still responsible, even though this is actually a distinction Simone de Beauvoir makes later, that there can be a difference between being responsible and being guilty. To the extent that you're a sheep. Yes.
Yeah. The Nazi youth is not guilty, though.
Yes, he's responsible. He's participating in the military campaign or whatever. But to the extent that he's not really an autonomous decision maker and not in the position where he could be or is denied essential information or is being oppressed. Yeah.
Yeah, to the extent that he's ignorant. But we don't have time to re-educate him, so we have to kill him. That's the conclusion she draws. But not because he's guilty, just because he's in the way.
So it's like Children of the Corn.
How? Children of the Corn?
You adults, you're just in the way. It's not that you're guilty, but we have to kill all of you anyway to get rid of the adultocracy. Yeah.
With aesthetic detachment.
I never watched that movie.
Yeah, I think it would be justified.
I think those kids are guilty of the serious man fallacy because they worship their leader as a religious cult leader.
They're in the world of the serious corn. The corn gods. I don't know. All right.
That's really corny.
But was the point against Stoicism made strongly enough? Do we want to talk about that?
That's kind of what we were just wrangling with. Because for the Stoic, they put the resistance of people and things into the same category. They're just the things over which we have no control, and so we can just write them off and not worry about it. And she's trying to say, no, those two things are different.
Yeah. She has a nice thing about how the oppressor can feign being the oppressed or couch it in the fact that it's like the weather. It's like the natural order of things. Not far after where Mark was reading. So the oppressed has only one solution, to deny the harmony of that mankind from which an attempt is made to exclude him, to prove that he is a man and that he's free by revolting against the tyrants. In order to prevent this revolt, one of the ruses of oppression is to camouflage itself behind a natural situation, since, after all, one cannot revolt against nature. When a conservative wishes to show that the proletariat is not oppressed, he declares that the present distribution of wealth is a natural fact, and that there is thus no means of rejecting it. And doubtless, he has a good cause for proving that, strictly speaking, he is not stealing from the worker the product of his labor, since the word theft supposes social conventions, which in other respects authorizes this type of exploitation. What the revolutionary means by this word is that the present regime is a human fact. As such, it has to be rejected.
So there you go. So the city with the high walls that is denying the people on the outside the water,
yep.
That is a human construction.
Yep.
And even though the individual humans in it might just say, well, it's the law of the group. The existence of the walls. It's just the way it is. Some things will never change. It's the Hornsby effect.
So we've confirmed that our privilege is a form of oppression. Is that what we're saying?
There you go. Okay. That was where I was going.
All right.
Well, the maintaining of that privilege and that status quo, because it would be from an argument like, we can't redistribute things because then you would be stealing from me. Is faulty logic, according to her, because you are not acknowledging the way in which you had been stealing in the first place. There's some movie or some, maybe it was Game of Thrones, the comment was made about how the kings became kings because they took it, right? And they're aristocrats not because of some natural order, even though once they become aristocrats, they will try to explain that this is the natural order. That this is just the way it is because we have naturally come here. We've risen out of the ground as being the greater men. No, no. We just took it, actually.
It's in the bloodline now.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
But so thinking back to the Nozick episode that we had, I mean, of course he would acknowledge that, yeah, you have to have just first conditions, that somebody just taking something, an original crime, is not the way to satisfy society. But if you did have just initial conditions, then there are, you know, legitimate and illegitimate ways, fair ways, you know, as long as there are free actions by which resources could get distributed. And then however the endpoint, however things end up, that is by definition fair because it obeyed those laws. And so this sort of comes from this unshakable respect, supposedly, for individual decision makers. And it seems like Du Bois is going to be committed to that idolization of that kind of freedom, of that kind of standard, is also in bad faith, is calling something essentially a natural right like that, calling it a part of human nature, is an improper stiffening of morality. That morality, just like it doesn't have God's laws written in the sky, it doesn't have fundamental rights in that way written in the sky either.
Well, I think you're right about making it almost a fallacy of seriousness, because she would immediately be deeply skeptical of the very first premise that it didn't start off as a crime. That's right at the beginning.
Sure. Yeah. Well, yes, as a practical matter.
But in fact, as a practical matter is, in fact, decisively important, because that's where the fallacy of seriousness comes in, is saying, okay, I have this argument that is deeply internally consistent and has the respect and proper ethical arrangement, but it's utterly hollow because the beginning is not possible.
Yeah, and that would fall into a general category of the other theme that goes throughout this third book here of Ethics of Ambiguity, is to embrace the concrete and the role that the concrete situation plays in ethical decision-making over principles, which sort of is a little ass backwards of the way that philosophers normally do ethical philosophy, that you have to apply the principle of utility or whatever the principle is, Kant's principle, in an impartial way, because people are fallible, and even if they sort of are morally good-hearted, when they get in particular situations, they're going to be fooled. They need guidance. They need these rules to let them judge the tricky cases. And I think she's going to think that any such rules that you're resorting to is cheating, is bad faith, is misplaced concreteness.
Nevertheless, we do get general guidance from her involving treating other people as ends. And a lot of this chapter is about sort of how to solve ethical dilemmas, especially when it comes to resisting oppression and when you can use violence and when you can and things like that. There are a few kind of general principles, even though she's not giving us maxims. So, I mean, I think we'll get to that. But the most general of all of them is just this idea of treating people's ends in themselves and willing their freedom.
I think we should get into those moral dilemmas in part two of the discussion that people can come back next week and listen to. But we're going to have it right now. So if you don't want to wait and you want to be just like us and continue on in a natural way without being interrupted by advertisements or anything like that,
don't be oppressed.
Go become. Exactly. I mean, the advertisement is a thing in the world, and this break between things is a thing in the world, but yet we're the ones doing it. So we're kind of oppressing them. But we are giving them a way around, so I'm not sure if that counts. Well, the way around is to go to partiallyexaminedlife.com, become a partially examined life citizen. You can even sign up for the citizen feed, so you can get this in your podcast app on your phone or whatever. You don't have to get all the citizen stuff. You don't have to just listen to it on the website. So go check that out. See you then.
Thank you again to our sponsor, Libertarianism.org. Libertarianism.org has hundreds of informative resources to learn about the theories, histories, and principles of free societies. There are podcasts, videos, free books, classic reprints, and insights from experts past and present. Learn more about free and open societies at Libertarianism.org.